actually think I'm getting when I go to a movie and I realize it's either been shot on digital or being projected in digital. I mean, some people feel differently about this, but I think it's the death keel. I think it's the death rattle.
Well, postpone the funeral for now. A high-profile group of filmmakers, including Quentin Tarantino, is banding together to save Kodak's motion picture film business. We'll have more on that later on in the show. But first, President Obama is speaking this hour about investing billions of dollars in Africa in an effort to spur private investment there. This week, he's convened the biggest summit ever of African heads of state and business leaders in Washington. African leaders are trying to change the narrative coming out of this meeting, trying to shift American attitudes about the continent. Our collective view of Africa, often one of dysfunction, disease, war, ethnic tensions. And that attitude, well, it may mean missing out on an explosion of economic growth in the region. Deo Olapade is a journalist and author of the book, The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa. And she's here now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, there are economies in Africa that are growing at a very rapid pace. Where are they? Where are the most dynamic economies in Africa?
Well, I mean, you could run down a list of countries that are experiencing accelerating levels of GDP, but I think that's not really the right way to think about the opportunity that is in modern Africa. Really, it's about growth outside of the extractive sector that we hear so much about, the oil, the minerals. You're seeing growth in services and agriculture in particular, in construction. You're seeing 22 out of 54 countries that are now middle income, that is, they have their hand on the rung of the ladder toward prosperity and are climbing up. And you have an emerging middle class that is about 300 million people. That's a population the size of the U.S., making 10 times the poverty benchmark of $2 a day. So I hear that statistic that Africa has 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world. And it's true, but it's much broader of a story than simply focusing on those national growth statistics. You have an extremely young population enabled with technology and more broader prosperity than Africa's ever seen before.
And how new is this prosperity?
I think it really varies. I think what I tell in my book is an old story that has new tools, right? Mm-hmm. Stories of entrepreneurship and innovation, of people doing more with less, of people making do in adverse circumstances. And, you know, I think this has a lot to do with some of the government dysfunction we have seen. For decades since independence, African citizens have been having to make do and plug holes left by the social safety net the governments haven't been good at maintaining. So you're seeing private solutions for education, dynamic solutions for off-grid energy, for private health services, for all kinds of things that are energizing formal and informal economies all across Africa in response to this sort of government dysfunction we hear more about in the U.S.
Right. So this is almost a libertarian idea that you can have prosperity outside of government without government doing anything.
Yes and no. I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in sub-Saharan Africa. One of the ventures I profile is an aluminum can factory in Nigeria. What a basic concept, but in an environment where most cans are made of steel and are imported from South Africa, creating an aluminum can factory to employ 2,000-3,000 workers not only provides local jobs, but, you know, affords people, this consumer class that is the new middle class in Africa, opportunities to buy things, to access opportunities that were otherwise excluded, that they were otherwise excluded from in the past.
Well, there are some limits to this, right? This free market approach that you need the government to provide some services. They have to build roads, for example, to get these goods, these aluminum cans, for example, to market.
You're exactly right. I think that a road is a very good example of the kind of infrastructure that the public and private sector need to work together to implement. I will say that, you know, in my time crisscrossing sub-Saharan Africa, I lived in Nairobi and traveled to 17 countries, you were seeing non-Americans working on exactly these sorts of private sector infrastructure deals. You were seeing Chinese labor. You were seeing, to a certain extent, Turkey, India, Japan, other countries aside from the U.S. investing alongside African governments in infrastructure and in goods and services. So I think those partnerships are what is driving, I think, what is the U.S. playing catch-up at this mm-hmm. point. I could tell you that China has probably had as many African leaders as you see in Washington today, dozens of times, you know, in the last 15 years. So the extent to which the U.S. is just now showing up to this conversation should not be overlooked, despite the fact that they are, you know, having this big celebration in Washington.
Yeah, yeah. So China, I think the statistics are, has invested $75 billion in Africa over the last decade. I think President Obama is expected to promise $14 billion today.
That's right.
And so, yeah, that is definitely a small number compared to $75 billion. But isn't there a devil's bargain in some instances with China in that, yes, they might be building roads and helping governments build roads, but they're also working to extract a lot, as you say, of oil and other minerals for their own industries and working alongside with dictators in countries like Sudan, Angola, Zimbabwe?
Yes, I think, you know, you'll find as many of those dictators are going to be eating at the White House tonight. I think, you know, being high-minded about what we talk about when we talk about leadership has led the United States to miss out on the opportunities, not just to support Africa, but to really benefit American companies. I think when you look at the leaders at this business summit today, they're from blue-chip companies, IBM, GE, even the newer companies, technology companies like Google. They all have a presence in Africa because they understand it's an expanding market. It's one where there will be enormous opportunities, particularly for this youngest demographic, and not just in, you know, consumption or, you know, cell phone talk time, but in really important industries and industrial growth that mirrors a lot of what you saw in East Asia, you know, in the second half of the 20th century and in Central Europe to a certain extent. So these are green fields for investment. To the extent that Chinese companies or other non-American companies are ignoring human rights, I think it's a huge problem. I think having more partners to trade with can offer African countries more leverage as they negotiate these kinds of, you know, infrastructure for resources deals. And I think the U.S.'s lack of participation and, to a certain extent, European companies' lack of participation only strengthens the hand of the less custodial non-democracies. And so showing up is really half the work for the U.S.
Deo Olopade, author of The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, what's the first thing you think of when you think of Africa? How has your attitude on Africa changed over the years or maybe after this very conversation? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or you can speak up on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. President Obama is encouraging American entrepreneurs to look to Africa as a place to do business and to get some perspective on what doing business in Africa is like right now. We've called Stephen Katsaros. He's the founder and CEO of a Denver-based company called Nokero, which makes portable solar lights. And Nokero, as in no kerosene, which is a much used energy source across Africa. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we just heard that this is a place to invest in, a booming place. And from your perspective, how do you compare it to working in places like Asia or even the United States?
Sure. You know, in places that you and I are living, there's known stores. We have a consumerism model and there's ways to bring for these other parts of the world, like Africa, there aren't traditional routes to market. We're actually creating methods for bringing the products into country and training people on how to sell, and it's quite an effort.
Did you anticipate that when you decided to go into Africa?
So I'm an inventor, you know, and inventors solve problems, and I love this idea of solving a great problem that costs $38 billion a year worldwide, and I always envisioned our company Nokero to be on the front end, just building the product and literally selling it FOB factory. We never envisioned how hard it would be to sell in these markets, and so now we've had to solve the problem and invent ways to run retail models and to get products actually sold to the people who need them most.
So where do you make your solar-powered lights? Where are they actually manufactured?
The manufacturing infrastructure for small-scale solar lights is in Asia, primarily China.
Okay, why don't you make them in Africa?
we're riding on the coattails of larger solar projects, mm-hmm. and the infrastructure that's been built up there. What's most likely to happen in the coming 5 years is do in-country assembly, and so we have a new product that we're releasing next week, which can be assembled in countries, and then we'll start to locally source certain components like injection molded parts. But the solar panels and the batteries and the LEDs are very, very high technology and specific to an infrastructure that exists for other products, not just solar lamps.
I see. And so then once you get them into Africa, what's the process like in terms of distributing? Can you just describe the
sure.
process of getting
sure.
a light
Africa's
from...
Africa is obviously a very, very large place. People, you know, here in the West just compartmentalize and treat it like it's Kentucky or something. But mm-hmm. every place is different. All the countries are different. So in the past, we've seen more aid-based sales. These are to institutional sales. So, for example, an extractive company bought 100,000 of our solar light bulbs, and they gave them away. We, as a sector and as a company, see about half of our products being purchased by trustees of beneficiaries, literally given away. The other half is what I'm most interested in, and that's what will occur exclusively over the next 5 years, is this reseller network. So in Kenya, I can tell you that we have an entity there. We have staff there. We bring our products into Mombasa. They go by rail up to Nairobi, where we've got a fulfillment center. And then we work with women's networks that hand deliver products and literally spend about a half hour per sale training somebody on what is good, you know, what's bad about kerosene, how much kerosene costs, you know, building up the process, much like what direct sales networks here in the United States do with various products.
So these women go from village to village talking about the benefits of solar-powered lights and trying to sell your product?
One of our partners runs that type of program. In other countries, we have hawker networks that are literally selling door-to-door at cars in an urban area, because there's a lot of urban energy poverty. You got to remember, there's 600 million people in sub-Saharan Africa that have no electricity, zero, and they never will have a grid. So this distributed generation and distributed light like we sell is critical to getting them on the road to commercial opportunity.
How much is one of your lights?
We have a range of products. They are as low as $7 or $8 at full retail price, all the way up to, we're going to be releasing a fishing light in the coming months that is going to retail for $180.
Wow.
But primarily at the very low end of that, extreme affordability is where the market is today.
But $7 or $8, I would imagine that's pretty expensive for a lot of Africans.
Yes. Now, that's the conservative number, giving full Keystone markup to the retailer. We obviously wholesale them much less than that. Remember, they're spending, this collective $38 billion a year on kerosene. Each little kerosene lamp that we replace is burning 40 liters of kerosene a year, and each liter of kerosene is $1.50. So that's $60 per year. So a product that is only at retail, $8, $7, whatever, is able to replace a $60 a year running cost.
So are you making money? Is this a good business investment to be in Africa, places like Kenya?
Yes. We've sold 1 million of our solar lights, and so our revenues are quite healthy. From a distribution to shareholders, that hasn't come yet because we're investing and growing. And just today I was negotiating a guy that's in Denver moving to Uganda. He's from Uganda. He's been living here for 12 years and positioning back there. So, there's a lot of investments that are needed, but the opportunity is huge, and we get support from a variety of entities all the way up to the World Bank and IFC, down to people who just like our product and go onto our website and buy a sample to explore what you know this renewable source of light is all about.
All right, Stephen Katsaros, founder and CEO of the Denver-based solar company NoCaro. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a group of high-profile filmmakers and Hollywood studios trying to keep Kodak's motion picture film division alive as more and more movies are being shot on digital. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hollywood is trying to save film. Several studios have agreed to buy large quantities of film from Kodak, which has seen such a big decline, it was about to close its film manufacturing plant. Big directors such as Quentin Tarantino, Christopher Nolan, and J.J. Abrams are behind the move to keep film alive. Even though most movies and TV shows are now shot on digital cameras and most movie theaters have switched to digital projection. Robert Richardson is a cinematographer who has worked with Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, Oliver Stone, and many other directors. And he's here now. He joins me from Vancouver, where he's shooting a commercial. Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm good. And are you shooting it on film or digital?
Digital.
Of course. So how often do you shoot on film?
I shoot on film. And the last film I shot on film was Django with Quentin.
Mm-hmm.
I did Kill Bill and Inglourious Bastards, all on film.
So he's a big proponent of film, I understand.
He's an astounding, yeah. I think that's, he will not make a film in the format that we currently are seeing in any other way than on celluloid.
And why is that? What's the difference in terms of what we see in the theaters?
Well, you're asking between the difference between what Quentin sees and what you and I would see. If you and I went into the movie theater, it'd be highly unlikely that you could tell the difference between the beam and what's on the screen, whether it be digital or it be in film.
Mm-hmm. But he sees a difference.
Yeah, he's also romantic. His experience in cinema has a long history, and that comes, in my opinion, it's the tool of his heart. If he's going to make something, he wants to make it in a format that represents the history of cinema as he has watched it.
And what about for you as a cinematographer? Do you think there is a difference?
I do. I think the film has a larger range in terms of the sensitivity. There's a grace to the way it captures skin tone. There is something that is a bit more alive. The grain itself is a part of the image. Even once scanned, you feel more of it. It is, I guess the best way to say it's alive.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with cinematographer Bob Richardson, and we're talking about the effort to save Kodak film. And Bob, you know, the dean of the USC Film School, Elizabeth Daly, told the Wall Street Journal that they only offer one advanced cinematography class in terms of teaching students how to work with film. So it seems that the tide is inexorably moving towards digital. Do you think that this effort to save film is quixotic and will be short-lived?
I don't know how short-lived it will be, but I do believe you're absolutely right that inevitably it will become all digital. It would be nice and it would be romantic to be able to hold on to the thought that we can provide for all future filmmakers the tool of film as a celluloid, a chemical process. But I believe that digital will make vast advances on how film captures and will surpass it.
What about for preserving films? Isn't it better to have movies on film than on digital in terms of how long they last?
Currently, most all films are now placed on film for preservation. In the speed at which digital capturing is altering, we need to move that digital format continually, which means constantly reproducing. And there's a danger in that we'll fall behind and certain films will get lost. I believe I recently read, and you might be able to correct me on this, that Toy Story 2 was erased by Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
And they resolve that because somebody had an original copy or near original copy. But the truth is we can lose it very quickly, whereas films, of course, we lose it if a vault gets destroyed or if the film's misplaced. But in essence, yes, all cinema, whether it's digital or film, is captured on film for posterity.
Do you think that there are advantages to using digital when you're shooting to using film?
Every film generally ends up in, whether it's shot on film and celluloid, whatever you prefer to call it, or whether it's captured in a digital manner, they end up going to a room where you sit with a man and or a woman and you color the film. You correct its densities, you correct its minute levels of color, you can build windows. There's a whole series of very complex things that you can do in the digital intermediate world. That is the greatest advantage of the digital format. It allows you to create better work than you can do on set at a much faster pace.
So you can't do that if you shoot on celluloid?
No, you can do it if you shoot on celluloid, but if you finish your film on, say, in other words, if you take your film in the old way, we used to shoot, say, when I did JFK, you had to finish in a manner which is you chemically correct it in a lab and you don't have the opportunity to do as much work with it as you can currently do in a digital manner. So if your work is not good when you shoot it, it's not going to be good when you complete the film in a photochemical manner. If you shoot a mediocre product, you can vastly improve it in the digital intermediate.
So if you are not as great a cinematographer, then you can kind of get away with something when you're shooting on digital.
Absolutely.
But for the finished product, does the moviegoer know the difference?
We all notice the difference between something that's well done and not well done. They're not going to notice the difference between whether it's digitally projected, I think, or whether it's photochemically projected. I think the difference that you and I would feel would be, well, it doesn't have a scratch, it doesn't bump when it goes through a splice, it doesn't jump out of focus. Those issues are pretty much rectified by the current system. For me, I actually love going to a cinema and seeing an image in focus all the time and not worrying about that, like I have to run to the backstage to get the projections to improve. But in truth, I don't think the majority of people notice.
Well, it's similar to the debate on sound. So a lot of people say, oh, I like that warm analog sound, but yet you have to deal with the scratches and the bumps and that extra sound.
You're absolutely right, and I think that's, like, if you listen to Neil Young's perspective, you know, what we download from iTunes is such a modest percentage of the quality of what was originally recorded by the artist.
Right.
And I think that there is a little bit of that in what we're doing, digitally speaking, because, you know, we're making things that people watch their movies on their iPhones or their Samsungs and their iPads and their computers. It really doesn't matter what the platform is, but we're walking further and further away from the grand hall. And I think that's what you'll see next with Quentin, for example, is he's shooting the largest format that film currently makes, which is 65 millimeter. And his intention is to release it, first of all, only on 70 millimeter, which is the way they release a 65 film. So it'll be released only in 70 millimeter. There will be no digital cinema presentation initially.
So was he making a statement, or who's going
to
show that?
How
are you
going to
see it?
There'll be X number of theaters that'll be open. It'll be more an event. It makes it more special. It's akin to going to the theater. You're going to have it in X number of theaters across the country. Who knows how many that'll be? It could be a few hundred that they'll modify and correct the systems to be at the very highest level. And that's the way that film's going to come out for us. Now, whether or not he holds to this plan, but it was an original thought, I don't know. But I do believe that idea of making it a special event in the cinema is something that we all need. It's becoming too common to walk into theaters and find that you can go to your home and almost have the same quality.
Yeah, that's so true. Robert Richardson, cinematographer who has worked with many directors, including Quentin Tarantino and Martin Scorsese. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So can you tell the difference if the movies you see are shot on film or on digital? Do you care? Leave us a message at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we might use your comment at the end of today's show. Coming up, another big California industry, wine, how it's faring during this drought. Plus, the story of a plot to poison the vines of one of the most sought-after wines in France. First, let's get a news update with Larry Perel.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to Press Play on KCRW. California's epic drought is bringing new meaning to the term dry wine. California makes about 90% of the country's wine, so let's find out how the drought is affecting the grapes. Jason Haas is a managing partner of the family-owned Tablas Creek Vineyard near Paso Robles, and he's here now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, I understand for the last year, Paso Robles has seen less than 2 inches of rain compared to a seasonal average of about 8 inches. So how has that affected your production?
Well, for us, we're enough west of Paso Robles that we get in a normal year almost triple what the city does, even though we're only 10 miles away. But the ratios are about the same. I mean, we're a little under 10 inches for the year. So I mean, it's still less than half of what is normal, and it's the third year in a row we've been around half of normal rainfall. So the impacts are that we're making less grapes, which will make a little bit less wine, and we're getting to the point where you're starting to worry that if the drought goes on another couple of years, it's going to start to impact the health of the vineyard itself. That hasn't happened yet, and we're all watching carefully, but we know it's out there.
What do you mean, the health of the vineyard itself?
Well, there's only so long that a grapevine can stay healthy if you're giving it half of the amount of water that it really needs. And you can supplement to a certain extent with irrigation, though we would certainly prefer not to, and in a normal year we don't. But there are also pressures on the amount of water that there is in the ground. And if you keep getting a lot less rain than what you are expecting, the water that you're expecting to find in the ground isn't going to be there in the same quantity.
And how does less water affect the grapes themselves, the taste and the wine, the final product of the wine?
To a certain extent, less water is a good thing. And really, grapevines are plants which evolved to live in places where they resisted regular droughts. I mean, they're from arid environments in the Middle East and around the Mediterranean, where they were planted in places where you couldn't grow more useful crops. They were planted on rocky hillsides and places where they would struggle. So to a certain extent, you want your grapes to have less water than they would really be happy with, because it gives you more intense flavors and makes for better wine. But there's also a limit to how far that can go. At a certain point, if you just don't give the vines enough water, they will make fewer and fewer grapes, and eventually you will shorten the lifespan of your vines themselves.
And have you moved up your production season? Are you picking the grapes sooner?
We are. This looks like it's going to be a pretty early year for us. We haven't started yet, but it's probably only a couple of weeks out, and that's maybe 2 weeks earlier than normal. But that is more a function of how warm the winter was, at least after the beginning of January, than it is of how much rain we've gotten. Things do ripen a little faster when you have less crop on the vines, but it's mostly the fact that we really didn't get a frost after February. And normally here you can get frosts all the way into the middle of May.
So what are you anticipating in terms of your wine production this year?
Honestly, the vineyard looks great. We're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. But the vines look like they're in great shape. We're not expecting a particularly high quantity of grapes. Our yields last year were a little below average, and we're expecting this year to be a little below last year. But in terms of evenness and ripening and health of the vines, things look super. I mean, I'm expecting a really good vintage this year. Mm. I'm just hoping we get some rain this winter so that we will have a vintage next year.
But if you don't get rain this winter, how are you talking about what you're going to do in terms of finding water to irrigate?
Yeah, we are. I think everybody around, all the members of the wine community who I talk to, they're probably spending more time talking about this than they are anything else. I mean, there are people who are drilling new wells. There are people who are planting in a different way. I mean, we've actually planted the vineyard, the new acreage that we've planted the last few years, we've planted much further apart, so the vines are much more widely spaced so that they can survive with less water from the outside. And you know you're going to take a hit in your production when you do that, but it seems like overall a trade-off that we're willing to make for a vineyard that'll be healthy over the longer term.
Well, thanks a lot.
Totally my pleasure.
That's Jason Haas. He's a managing partner of the Tablas Creek Vineyard. In a moment, we're going to go to France for a very different kind of wine story. Poison, intrigue, and booze. All key components of an unusual crime that played out a few years ago in the French countryside. A career criminal threatened to poison the grapes in a world-renowned vineyard unless its owner paid a steep ransom. The caper that unfolded shines a light on the rarefied world of fine wines and the colorful characters that inhabit it. Maximilian Potter writes about all of this in his new book. It's called Shadows in the Vineyard, the true story of the plot to poison the world's greatest wine. And he joins me now. Hi.
Hey, thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And set the scene. Tell us about the Burgundy region of France and why it is so legendary.
Well, the Burgundy region is about a 4-hour drive south of Paris. And the Côte d'Or is the heart of Burgundy. And the heart of the Côte d'Or is a little town, a little hamlet called Vaune-Romanée, a village that is the home of probably 15 to 20 of the top wines in the world.
And within that region is a very, very small vineyard. It's called La Romanée-Conti, and it is the most prized vineyard in that small region.
Yeah, and arguably it's the most prized vineyard in the world.
Aubert de Villene runs it. He runs this vineyard. And in January 2010, he gets a ransom note.
It says that an entity, an unnamed entity, the authors of the note, have gone to great lengths to destroy the vineyard. And if the domain wants to save the vines, it should look in its mailbox in coming days. And again, in Burgundian culture, this is somewhat akin to an attack on a religion. This crime was so potentially devastating to Monsieur de Villene personally. This is a man who is, in my opinion, put on earth to have a family and raise children. And he and his wonderful wife, despite many efforts, were unable to do so. And the vines were his children.
So what did the bad guy in this case, what did he want?
He wanted 1 million euro in cash to be delivered in a suitcase to a cemetery in a nearby town after the sun went down. That's what he wanted. But this is the really unnerving thing about the crime for many in this business, which is there's not a lot you can do to protect a vineyard. It just lays there exposed, open, vulnerable to all the world. The crime was unprecedented. No one had ever attacked vines this way.
How exactly did he attack them? What did he do? And by let's name him. His name is Jacques Soltis.
Well, what Jacques Soltis did is he came down from his hideout that he had built for himself over many months in the mountain above the vineyards. He'd come out around 1 in the morning, midnight, come walking down the hillside, and for a period of months, he drilled hundreds of holes with a power cordless drill where the vine meets the earth, right beneath the soil. He actually injected into this hole a fairly common herbicide, Roundup. It was a French version of Roundup. And he shot it into these vines, and it killed them pretty quickly.
Hmm. So he was ready, and he was prepared to do that to all of them if he didn't get his 1 million euros?
Yes.
And so then how is he caught?
the Police Nationale, that's the equivalent of the French FBI. They handled this case. That's the significance that it had. It didn't go to the local police, which would have been the gendarmerie, your neighborhood police department. It went to the best of the best, the serious cops. And they put counterfeit euro in the suitcase, dropped off the bag, and within 20 minutes, one of the bad guys came and the police surrounded him and caught him.
Just like that.
Just like that.
I mean, I can't believe, like, after all that planning, that meticulous planning he did when it came to poisoning the vines and sussing out the vineyard, it didn't occur to him that there would be a sting operation.
That's pretty much when the police knew they weren't dealing with a mastermind. And there seems to be a disconnect from phase one and phase two of this plan. The reason was is the whole plan itself wasn't really Jacques' idea. He got the idea while he was in prison for almost a decade. A cellmate, a disgraced French aristocrat, says to him, "Listen, you might want to think about holding a vineyard hostage." And this nobleman pretty much laid out for him the whole first phase of the plan.
So the vineyard is saved. Jacques Soltis, however, he didn't end up so well.
He didn't end up so well. But I think that the saddest thing for me is that Jacques' accomplice, it was his son. His son is named Cedric. And Cedric grew up without a father because his father was a career criminal and in jail for most of Cedric's life. And so here we have a moment around, 2009, when Cedric's father, after close to 10 years in prison, is coming out. And all Cedric wants to do is bond with or be with or really get to know his dad. And so what his dad says to him from prison is, "Hey, I'm planning this awesome caper, and I think it would be great for us to pull off together." And Cedric ultimately acquiesces and says, "Sure, I'll do it." And I spent, many hours interviewing Cedric's mom, Jacques' wife, and she made it pretty clear, as did neighbors, that Cedric pulled off this crime because he loved his dad. The ultimate sadness here is that Jacques takes his own life and leaves Cedric on the hook to face the charges for it. And then what we also have is the wine going to, are the vines actually going to survive? While Jacques only poisoned four vines, he drilled into hundreds. And these vines are very vulnerable plants. In the back of Monsieur de Villene's mind is, what do we got? What are we dealing with here? Are these vines going to bear fruit? He did okay.
Now, if only I could get my hands on some of that wine.
You and me both, sister. Trust me, I won't be drinking that again anytime soon.
Well, did you get to taste it when you were reporting?
I did. There's very little first person in the book, but at the end, I reveal a little bit about who I am. And I grew up in Philly, real working class neighborhood. You know, it was Schmitz, Schlitz, Paps, a shot. You're talking roofers, firemen, cops. There wasn't a lot of Grand Cru's in Philadelphia, not where I grew up. And to be honest, when I was assigned this story, when I pitched it to Vanity Fair way back when, I thought the whole concept of terroir, which is sort of the umbrella term for what makes the geography and geology and soil of this place so special, and terroir refers to sort of the ecosystem of the vineyard. I thought all of this stuff was just bananas. And when I went over there, it wasn't just the taste that blew my mind. It was realizing how ignorant I had been about all of those other things. I did get to taste Romani Conti, and I tasted what is critics believe are their two best appellations. And I'm telling you, it is the best thing I've ever had in my mouth in my life. It filled me with a warmth. And as I write in the book, it really is like a sensation. There's a divinity and a gracefulness and a life in that liquid that I just had never experienced before.
Maximilian Potter is a journalist, and he's written a book called Shadows in the Vineyard, The True Story of the Plot to Poison the World's Greatest Wine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A divinity in that wine, Warren
Divinity.
Almy. What are we
that
doing
is a
here?
Term. We're in the wrong, sitting in the wrong place, doing the wrong thing. Get me a glass.
Exactly. It's afternoon. Time for wine. And also time for your show.
Time for my show, yeah. We are going to talk, it appears that there is so much instability, so much violence, so much unhappiness around the world that we're in a sort of time of chaos. And we'll have three very interesting people talking about that. One who thinks that this may be a harbinger of World War III. He doesn't want to predict it. But he says that the elements are there, particularly if you look at the situation and what it was before World War I, where everybody thought that was unthinkable. Well, we think it's unthinkable now. But there are a lot of things going wrong. Others are saying, no, forget it. That's not the case. Maybe the United States isn't the superpower that can do everything at once anymore. Maybe it never will be again. But that doesn't mean that we're going to get into World War III. And a third person who sort of splits the difference between the two. It's a big picture kind of show and very, very interesting, very exciting. It's fun to do.
Okay, good. Look forward to that at 1 o'clock to the point with Warren Almy. Thank you very much. Thank you. And coming up on this show, sci-fi, usually a sure thing when it comes to box office money, but there is a rich world of independent science fiction films that are asking big questions, even if they're not making big bucks. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. It's summer, so that means the box office is again being invaded by bombastic science fiction and fantasy blockbusters.
We have plans for you, Peter Parker.
Who sent you here?
I have access to 28% of my cerebral capacity. I can feel every living thing.
Patience isn't my strongest suit.
But some smaller sci-fi films have snuck into theaters as well. Movies that rely more on story and character than on star power and special effects. Matt Holzman is here to tell us about them. He's a producer here at Press Play, and also he hosts KCRW's screening series, First Take. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Madeline. I want to just start by saying that the movies that you were talking about, Transformers and Spider-Man and X-Men and even Lucy, those are science fiction films, I think, very loosely. What they are is action films that have this kind of science fiction patina. If those blockbusters are sci-fi, they're a kind of sci-fi that's just an extension of like the bad 50s B-movie sci-fi. They're kind of just a very expensive version of those movies.
Yes, it came from outer space to fill the world with terror, to bring you unforgettable suspense.
So what's the difference between these movies and real science fiction?
Where did it come from?
Well, I'm not going to say that they're not real science fiction, but I'll say that they don't do what science fiction, for me, really should do, and that science fiction gives you an opportunity to really look at what we might be someday, but also take a look at who we are now in the context of who we might be one day. So it frees you from a lot of the kind of bounds that you might have in a normal drama film to ask some of these big questions about, you know, the state of humanity. Whereas in the films that we just talked about, the Transformers films, the science fiction really is just an opportunity to be freed from any kind of logic, right?
so something more arty, more intellectual, more thoughtful, that's what you're talking about?
You know, it doesn't have to be. I mean, there have been huge science fiction films, Blade Runner, Minority Report, films that had the best of both worlds. They had huge budgets and great visual effects, but they also were asking some of these bigger questions. But yeah, you really don't need those things. I mean, a great example to me is Luis Buñuel's Exterminating Angel in 1962.
It's a bunch of upper class people at a dinner party, and for some reason they can't escape, they're trapped.
Right, they can't leave the house. And I hear some people saying, gee, you know, that's a surrealist film. Well, I mean, surrealism is a form of science fiction to me, and this is a great example of what science fiction can do. You take this premise, this otherworldly premise, and it lets you ask questions about the way people behave.
Calma ante todo, señores. Peor que el pánico no hay nada.
And this is a movie that asks questions about people's hypocrisy, but it's also a movie that was used to criticize the ruling class in Franco Spain. So here is a movie that took what I would call a sci-fi premise and used it to really look at what was happening right then in the world.
Okay, so let's get to this summer's indie sci-fi films and the ones that you've picked that use story and character well.
Right. Well, it's not just the ones that I picked. These are all ones that came out in the last 6 to 8 weeks. And it's interesting that this summer just had a bunch of these kind of indie sci-fi films come out. One actually is available on video on demand right now. It'll be in theaters on the 22nd of August. It's called The One I Love. And this is a movie that features Mark Duplass, who's known as the Mumblecore King, a super indie actor, and Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men. And it's a film about a couple that's having some problems, and they go away to a little retreat. And I won't tell you what happens, but I'll just say it asks the question, if you were a better version of yourself, would you still be yourself?
Baby, are you okay?
I'm
fine. Are you okay? I'm
okay, Mr. Hangover. I think it's time for some food. Huh? Let's get something in your stomach.
You're kind of freaking me out a little bit, Sophie. I gotta... Is that bacon?
Yeah.
You hate it when I eat bacon.
Another one of these films is called I, Origins, and it opened a couple of weeks ago. I believe it's available on video on demand right now. But this is the story of a couple of scientists who discover that reincarnation may be a scientific fact.
When I saw you, I had the feeling that I had known you. Like we are connected from past lives.
I don't believe in that.
What do you believe in?
I'm a scientist. I believe in proof.
This movie takes a logical left turn very hard. And if you're not holding onto your seat very tightly, you might go off in the other direction. But if you decide...
So you have to go along for the ride. You have to suspend your disbelief.
Absolutely. And I will say that people would argue, gee, with Transformers, you have to do that as well. And I would say in this case, if you do go along for the ride, what you get back is a lot more at the end of the movie. So that's another one, I, Origins. And the last one is one that opened in June, and it is available this week on video on demand called Coherence. And this one actually reminds me of Exterminating Angel, the Buñuel movie that we talked about before. But this is some folks at a dinner party, and a meteor goes overhead, and the lights go out for a little bit. They come back on, and in looking through the neighborhood around the house, they discover that the lights are out except for another house down the block.
Baby, what did you see?
What did you see?
We don't even belong here.
Everybody knew about this.
He told us. Everybody knew about this
except me.
We have to just get through the night, okay?
We are not from this house. We are visitors.
I'm crossing all kinds of boundaries.
I don't want to be stuck here.
What is going on?
Jesus!
And all of these movies, really, they're all about identity. And again, these are movies that are asking questions about the human experience, using these sci-fi kind of tropes as a way into what can be really boring. You know, how many more dramas can we have about, you know, an unhappy family?
Tolstoy would answer that in the affirmative.
Yeah, right.
But anyway.
Just one last movie I want to throw in there. In 2008, a movie came out called Sleep Dealer, and it's been re-released on video on demand. You can watch it on iTunes and elsewhere. And it's a movie about what they call cyber braceros.
A young man risks everything to plug in to the new American dream. All the work without the workers.
Basically, it's immigrant labor without the immigration. But it's a really interesting and fun to watch film, and it actually sounds like it hits you over the head with its issues, but it doesn't.
Okay, so the one I love, I, Origins, Coherence, and Sleep Dealer. Are you loving these movies, or... what's your critical reaction to them?
All of these movies were movies that I thought were very interesting and definitely worth seeing, but none of them were movies that I loved unreservedly.
Is there one that you did that you could recommend?
There are many indie sci-fi movies that I could recommend, and I'll just choose one called Moon that came out a couple of years ago, 2009, I believe. And it's a classic sci-fi in the sense that it takes place in space, and it looks like a space sci-fi movie. And it's about one guy, Sam Rockwell. He's on a moon station, and he's working there by himself. And he's starting to go mad a little bit. The writing is incredible. The performance is incredible. And it's another movie that really asks, you know, what makes us... us.
What's going on? Where did he come from? Why does he look like me?
You've been up here too long, man. You lost your marbles.
And I can't recommend it enough.
Moon, and this is by...
Duncan Jones directed it. He's the son of David Bowie.
Oh, the original Space Oddity himself.
Indeed.
Matt Holzman, producer here at Press Play, and he's also host of KCRW's screening series, First Take. You can read about these films and his other favorite indie sci-fi flicks at kcrw.com/firsttake. Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7.
Commencing.
Six.
Countdown engines on.
Jolie Myers is here now with the mail. Hi.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
I actually only answer to Major Tom now, so...
I was going to call you Press Play Oddity, but I changed my mind.
Press Play Oddity, also accurate. Both of those things are on my business card now. Well, we talked about Africa in light of the Summit of African Leaders in D.C. this week. We talked about that at the top of the show. And specifically, we were looking at how the average American thinks of Africa. Jeanette called in with her thoughts.
My first thought when I think of the continent of Africa is how much famine happens year after year in many of the countries there, and it's sad. I think the governments of the countries in Africa should take responsibility to teach about contraception. There are too many millions of babies born into famine.
So our guest at the top of the show, Dae Olapade, would argue that that's an outdated opinion, that the young population of Africa is a major economic driver for the region, the thing that's actually going to put an end to things like famine. A lot of our listeners joined the conversation on Africa on Facebook. We asked listeners there to tell us the first thing they think of when they think of Africa. David Cooper says the first thing that comes to his mind is the word potential. So there's a nice optimistic view. Someone named Art is Great says he thinks of how colonists have exploited the continent for the last 500 years, a little bit of a dimmer view. And Kevin Joel says that, to be honest, right now he's thinking of the Ebola outbreak and when it'll jump to the U.S. But Mark Edelstein says that he went to Africa a few years back. He saw a population that was warm, intelligent, resourceful, and a government with officials that were corrupt, often impeding the progress of the people they were supposed to be governing. But he also says that he kept wondering about all these ditches he kept seeing along the side of the road. They were everywhere, and turns out they were for cables that would bring high-speed internet to the places that Mark was visiting. So lots of infrastructure being built, perhaps progress as well.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, if you have anything that you would like to add to that, you can on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play, or you can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.